Welcome to today's program. My name is Jim Armitage, and I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And today I have the great pleasure to be joined by Dr. Andy Zelenets, who is from Memorial Sloan Kettering and a professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. These are our disclosures. All right, today's program is going to address directions on the frontline treatment of patients with the most common lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. In this presentation, Dr. Zelenets is going to discuss key data from recent publications and conferences and emerging frontline approaches for the treatment of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And he will discuss with us current and potential practice implications. And after that's over, Andy and I will talk for a little bit about some of the issues that we both think are interesting and important and that you might want to hear his opinion about. But right now, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Andy Zelenets.
Thank you, Dr. Armitage, and thank you for the invitation to join you today. If we're going to talk about large cell lymphoma, I think an appropriate place to start is to discuss classification, particularly since we've recently updated the classification of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So the WHO classification of lymphoid neoplasms was last updated in 2016. It's currently being undergoing an update. Unfortunately, we have sort of a split in the updated classification. There is the international consensus classification that was recently published in Blood, which I show here. It's sort of beyond the scope of today's discussion to discuss the differences between this international consensus classification and the new proposed WHO classification, but they're not dramatically different. But one of the things that you can see is that there are a number of new entities in, and this is the aggressive large cell lymphoma. This is not all lymphomas. The entities in entered in blue are considered provisional entities. But one thing I do point out is that lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin lymphoma has now been renamed to nodular lymphocyte predominant B cell lymphoma because it actually has no relationship to classical Hodgkin lymphoma. So these are the entities, you can see that there's a wide variety of different aggressive lymphomas. So the fact that outcomes are heterogeneous are not that surprising. So let's talk about first-line therapy. That's our topic today. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on early-stage disease. The early-stage algorithm is pretty straightforward. First, you want to know, is it PMBL or not? Because if it's PMBL, then the treatment is going to be dose-adjusted EPOC. At Memorial, we use a sequential regimen of R-CHOP followed by ICE or RICE. The outcome of these two regimens is identical. If it's large cell lymphoma and it's not PMBL, then we want to know whether there's bulk, because if there's no bulk, patients can be treated without radiation therapy, particularly if their PET scan is negative after treatment. Observation is appropriate. If the PET scan is positive, we're going to do involved site radiation. For patients who have slightly less favorable disease, they have their older age, their LDH is elevated, they have stage 2 disease, not stage 1 disease, their performance status is 2 or greater, then we're going to treat those patients with 4 cycles of R-CHOP, get a PET scan, do 2 more cycles of R-CHOP, and then, again, based on that PET-4, if the PET-4 is positive, we're going to consolidate with radiation, but we can avoid the radiation if the PET-4 is negative. For patients with bulky disease, or have multiple unfavorable risk factors, those patients should be treated as if they have advanced stage disease, though with involved site radiation therapy. But let's talk about the more common presentation, and that is with advanced stage disease. And this is the NCCN guidelines, and this is about the simplest NCCN guideline we have. Advanced stage disease, give R-CHOP. And where does this come from? Well, this comes from the original Gila study, which has been confirmed in multiple randomized studies, but with very long-term follow-up, we know that R-CHOP provides superior event-free survival and long-term overall survival advantage. I'm always amazed by this curve because the curves continue to separate even many years after the completion of therapy. So this is the international standard of care. It's good. It clearly, we improved the outcome of patients. We're curing close to 60% of patients with advanced stage large cell lymphoma, but we're not curing, but 40% of patients aren't being cured. So obviously we want to try to improve things. So how do we do that? Well, we've tried alternative chemotherapy. So we've tried adding etoposide to CHOP. That did not improve either progression-free or overall survival. We tried an alternative chemotherapy program, RACBP, which is actually a sequential chemoimmunotherapy program that also includes cytarabine and ifosfamide. This is one of the most ignored results because there was not only a progression-free survival, but an overall survival advantage in this prospective randomized trial. However, there's a major caveat. Only patients 18 to 59 were included, and only patients with an international prognostic score of 1. Were included. So this is why this has never really been adopted. There's also this concern that, it includes Vindicin, though most patients actually, even in France, were not treated with Vindicin, but were treated with Vincristine. RCHOP-14, so let's just give it more frequently. Unfortunately, two different studies, negative for both progression-free and overall survival. Let's change the antibody. Let's give obinutuzumab rather than rituximab. Again, no difference. Dose-adjusted EPOC, what was thought to be a very promising regimen, prospective randomized trial from the Alliance, no difference in progression-free or overall survival. Well, so if we can't improve by rearranging the deck chairs or adding a drug, what about adding maintenance? That seems to have been beneficial in indolent lymphoma and mantle cell lymphoma. So what about large cell lymphoma? Well, it has been studied. Rituximab has been used in a couple of different trials. In the U.S. intergroup trial, there was no overall progression-free overall survival benefit for the addition of rituximab maintenance. This was somewhat of a difficult trial because of interaction between the arms, but still statistically no difference between the two treatments. There was a European study that looked at rituximab maintenance. There was a improvement, a statistically significant improvement with a 32% reduction in risk of progression. But unfortunately, this did not translate to a statistically significant difference in overall survival. Enzastaurin has been looked at based on the work of Margaret Shipp, that was negative. Lenalidomide, like the European rituximab study, was positive for progression-free survival, but there was actually close to a trend for a negative overall survival, so a survival disadvantage. And that was because these were older patients and there was a lot of cumulative toxicity from the lenalidomide maintenance. Everolimus has been tested. So there are a couple of trials that sort of suggest some maybe improvement in progression-free. So what about doing a meta-analysis? And that has been done. And if we look at a meta-analysis of maintenance after R-CHOP for large cell lymphoma, unfortunately, there's no suggestion of a improvement in overall survival. So if you can't beat them, what about joining them? So let's take R-CHOP 21, but add something to it. And so this has been a well-studied approach. Bortezomib, based on molecular studies, should have been superior for patients with activated B-cell tumors. So in this trial, patients received one cycle of R-CHOP while their tumors were tested. And then if they were activated B-cell, they were randomized to receive bortezomib or not. And unfortunately, no difference in progression-free or overall survival. The Phoenix trial took a different approach. Everyone was tested before they went on study, but based on the Hans algorithm. And then they were tested molecularly. And this trial was negative for both progression-free and overall survival. However, there was an unplanned subset analysis, and I'm going to talk more about this in a moment, that there was a clear overall survival advantage for patients under the age of 60. And the question was whether it was a biological basis or toxicity in older patients. I'll give you my takeaway. I think it's toxicity, and I'll show you some data. Lenalidomide also was supposed to be preferential for non-germinal center tumors. A large randomized study showed no difference in progression-free overall survival. In a slightly different design, the ECOG did a phase two randomized study where they took all comers, and they showed a small advantage in progression-free survival with a p-value of 0.03, but I caution that this was a one-sided p-value. So if you use a two-sided p-value, it's 0.06 and not statistically significant. And unfortunately, it did not translate to a overall survival advantage. The most recent addition was the addition of polatuzumab to CHOP. There was a difference in progression-free survival that was statistically significant, meeting the primary endpoint. The study is still relatively early, so no difference in overall survival to date. And then there was a phase 1-2 study in which venetoclax was added to R-CHOP when done as a matched case control to historical data from the Goya study. We show that there was an overall survival advantage of adding venetoclax in BCL2 expressing tumors, though this needs to be confirmed in a prospective randomized study. So let's talk about the POLARIX study, which was a positive study. Polatuzumab is a antibody drug conjugate. It targets the B cell protein called CD79B. It delivers auristatin or MMAE to the tumor. It binds to the CD79B protein. It's endocytosed, and the drug is then released from the antibody, and it is a very potent microtubule disruption. This was initially studied in relapse refractory disease with bendamustine or rituximab, with or without polatuzumab, and there was both a progression-free and overall survival advantage. This actually led to the approval of polatuzumab for the relapse refractory setting. It also led to the upfront study of R-CHOP versus R-CHIP polatuzumab, using polatuzumab as a substitute for vincristine because they both have a similar mechanism of action. Both are microtubule drugs. A large study with almost 900 patients, well-balanced for, and the median follow-up was 28 months at time of publication. And here are the results. This was the primary endpoint. An investigator assessed progression-free survival, showing a 6% improvement in progression-free survival. To date, no improvement in overall survival. So the question will become, how do we use this? And I think one of the things that is, well, gee, is there a subgroup where there's a bigger benefit or not? And in the forest plots, there's a very interesting observation. This needs more follow-up and we need to understand it better. But shockingly, and this was a big surprise to everyone, that all of the benefit of adding polatuzumab to CHOP was for the activated B cell tumors. Molecularly, I can't explain this, but we actually have several sets of data to suggest that this is probably correct. So it seems that all of the benefit is in this subgroup that was unexpected. We would have expected it to benefit everybody if it had benefited anybody. So I want to turn back a little bit to the BTK inhibitor, because this had such strong biology for it. We did an initial study. This was a multi-center study. And what we found is that single agent ibrutinib was largely beneficial for people with activated B cell tumors, and in particular, people who had mutations of CD79B or MYD88. And interestingly, those which we consider sort of hyper-addicted to BTK-driven pathway represent about 10% of nodal activated B-cell lymphomas, but interestingly, about 37% of primary central nervous system lymphomas, a large proportion of testicular lymphomas, and of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma leg type, these somewhat unusual extranodal lymphomas. So let's go back to the PHOENIX trial. As I told you, the primary endpoint, which was a progression-free survival, there was no difference in non-germinal center versus of ibrutinib versus non-placebo. This is by Hans, done by NanoString using gene expression profiling. Again, no difference. But here's that unplanned subset analysis that I mentioned. A big difference in event-free survival, and interestingly, an important difference in overall survival. If we look at the older patients, they actually had a survival decrement. I believe this is, they did have higher toxicity, and I actually think that is the explanation. And I'll explain why I think the explanation in the next couple of slides. So if we look at the PHOENIX trial and we go back to not just ABC versus GCB, but we dive a little deeper into the molecular subtypes. Interestingly, what we find is that younger patients have slightly different distribution of lymphomas than older patients. Older patients are more likely to have MCD tumors. They're less likely to have N1 tumors, and they're a little bit less likely to have the BN2 tumors. Now, if we look at the outcome in the PHOENIX trial of these different tumors, these are the younger patients. MCD, clearly an enormous benefit for adding ibrutinib in the MCD tumors. BN2 tumors, no difference. N1 tumors, again, a big difference in favor of adding ibrutinib in the younger patients. Both of these groups, MCD and N1, are more frequent in the older patients. But when we do the same analysis for older patients, we actually see a poor outcome for ibrutinib in the MCD patients. So I think it's toxicity, not biology. We have to figure out how to give these treatments safer to derive the benefit for older patients. So this is being explored in a number of trials, trying to ask the question, how can we incorporate BTK inhibition to improve outcome in large cell lymphoma? Because this is one of the most intriguing leads that we have. And to sum up, R-CHOP remains the international standard of care in first-line treatment of large cell lymphoma. Substitution of polatuzumab improved progression-free survival by 6%. So far, no difference in overall survival. A curious observation that the benefit is in activated B-cell tumors only. though the Phoenix trial was negative, younger patients had this intriguing benefit for overall survival. And so there are a number of trials that are undergoing to try to answer this question, how do we integrate BTK inhibitors into activated B-cell tumors to improve outcomes for all patients? So with that, I'll stop. And Dr. Armitage, I'm happy to have a discussion about large cell lymphoma.
Dr. Zelnitz, or Andy, since we've been friends for longer than most of the people watching have been alive, probably. But at any rate, I have some questions for you, because I think we have here in you a real live expert with a huge experience in studying this disease. So I'm going to ask you some things that I think people would like to know about how you actually do stuff. So you have a patient that, for whatever reason, either doesn't want to be on or is ineligible to be on a clinical trial with a new diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Would you today take into account that information you so nicely discussed about subgroups in the new classifications into account when you make a treatment recommendation?
Though we clearly see this benefit on this, post hoc analysis of Phoenix with a big improvement for the MCD tumors and the N1 tumors in younger patients, the problem is we have not yet reduced this to routine clinical determination. So to make that diagnosis in real time, in a time frame that's appropriate for clinical care, we're not quite there yet. So, would I take a non-GCB, because that's the best we have, non-GCB by Hans, a younger patient, would I be tempted to include ibrutinib? And the answer is yes, I would be tempted to. The problem is I pretty much can't get it approved because I actually have tried in a number of cases, and most of the time, because the trial was negative, an insurance company is not going to give us access to the drug.
Yes, that's the problem that I anticipated and that we run into, that these drugs are so expensive. If we can't get it paid for, it's a relatively small proportion of patients who could afford to pay for it themselves. All right, next question. Same thing. How you approach a patient that isn't otherwise going to be on a trial where the treatment would be determined by that. Are there any subgroups other than mediastinal or people with a very, very high Ki-67, like a Burkitt-like proliferative fraction, where you would consider either EPOCH-R or the regimen that you all have developed at Memorial as opposed to CHOP-R?
What we call high-grade lymphoma with translocation of MYC and BCL2 or MYC and BCL6, those tend to be treated without randomized data, I will point out. With dose-adjusted EPOCH-R, there is not universal consensus that is the correct approach because of the absence of randomized data. The one group that I treat a little differently, and it's based on data that has been reported you will see in publication form hopefully soon, that our regimen of R-CHOP times 4 cycles followed by rice for 3 cycles has been particularly effective for non-GCB diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. In fact, our outcomes in the non-GCB patients are superior with that regimen than they are for germinal center tumors. So that's the one group that outside the setting of a clinical trial, I would use our R-CHOP rice regimen.
You do it all as an outpatient?
We do the R-CHOP obviously is an outpatient. We do the ICE is usually we admit for 1 day. We do part of the ICE as an outpatient, but we do admit for 1 night simply because the infusional Ifosfamide can be tricky as an outpatient.
Okay, another practical point. As I think you and I do in Hodgkin lymphoma and certain other situations, the interim PET scans become a really useful tool in a number of things. But in a disease where the thing that matters here is the PET scan at the end of therapy, does it make any sense to do interim PETs routinely in patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, with the exception that you showed us of localized disease?
So this is a controversial area. My opinion is no. We're not going to, we have no evidence that changing treatment based on interim PET is necessary. We know from prospective data that we published that was biopsy controlled. So we took essentially 200 patients that were on a trial. Every interim positive PET scan got biopsied. There were 70 positive PET scans, 7 positive biopsies. The positive interim PET did not really predict outcome. I actually use the end of treatment PET. There is an exception. Of course, there's always an exception, right? And the exception is, if someone has like largely osseous-based disease that's CT invisible, then I will get that interim PET, but that's really just to make sure that they're responding to treatment. If someone has CT occult disease, then those patients should have an interim PET. But in terms of the way we use it in Hodgkin lymphoma to make decisions, no, I think an end of treatment PET is adequate.
I really appreciate you doing all this. I want to pick on you one last thing. We'll pick your brain one more time. Other than CNS, mediastinal, and testicular, are there other primary sites that you think the people listening to you today should consider an alternative approach?
Diffuse large B-cell lymphoma leg type has a poor outcome. There's a high risk of CNS involvement. They are testicular and CNS, hyper addicted to the BTK pathway, frequently with MyD88 and CD79 mutations. Those are patients who I would actually consider using dose-adjusted EPOC. Those are the patients, if they came to me, because we have it open, I would put them on the ESCALADE trial, which is revisiting the question, one of the trials revisiting the question of the role of BTK inhibitors in large cell lymphoma.
Andy, that was a wonderful, clear presentation. And you just gave people all sorts, if they just bothered to listen to the things you said for the last 5 or 10 minutes, all sorts of things they can use to improve practice. So thank you so much for doing that for us. You take care of yourself.
And thanks for having me. This was fun.